Hi, and welcome to today's Norwalk Hour. I'm Brian Burgess, and we'll begin with a front page article from the Wednesday, March 27th edition, headlined, Cities Face Education Border War. This front page article by Alex Putterman. Connecticut is home to some of the nation's starkest inequality between neighboring school districts, new data shows. As part of a project examining disparities in education, the Washington, D.C.-based think tank New America analyzed thousands of adjacent school systems across the United States, comparing the median household income of one district against the other. By this measure, previously unpublished data shows Connecticut is home to 23 of the 300 most unequal borders in the country, including 8 of the top 100. In most cases, these borders are between the state's largest cities and their suburbs, though in some instances the disadvantaged district is a small city or a suburb. The border between Hartford and South Windsor represents the starkest disparity, followed by Hartford and West Hartford. Bridgeport and Fairfield, Bridgeport and Trumbull, and Waterbury and Cheshire. Only three states have more entries on the top 100 than Connecticut, and all three, California, Ohio, and New Jersey, have much larger populations. Zahava Stadler, project director for New America's Education Funding Equity Initiative, attributed Connecticut's prominence on the list to the state's high level of inequality, as well as its tightly drawn town borders and municipally run school systems. It is absolutely notable that a state of the size of Connecticut has so many of the 100 most segregating borders by this metric, and it tells us two things, Stadler said. One, there's a lot of inequality in the state of Connecticut, and it's showing up in our schools. And two, Connecticut has altogether too many school districts. Whereas in some places, diverse municipalities share resources under regional or county school districts, Stadler said, Connecticut districts are typically defined by municipal borders, leaving poorer communities separated from wealthier ones. Disparities between neighboring districts directly affect students, Stadler said, limiting opportunities for those in poorer communities. Data from the Hartford-based School and State Finance Project shows that Connecticut's poorest cities often spend far less per pupil on education than their wealthier neighbors, despite receiving significant state and federal aid. New America collected data on income disparities among neighboring school districts as part of a national report on the subject, which cites Connecticut as being home to some particularly stark divides. What we were looking at is, where do borders most powerfully separate kids from resources and from each other? Stadler said. In Connecticut and elsewhere, these socioeconomic gaps correlate closely with racial disparities, the report notes, with heavily Black and Latino districts often poorer than majority white ones. Jordan Abbott, a data analyst who co-wrote the New America report with Stadler, called Connecticut a really clean and clear example of how district borders drive segregation. Districts have been drawn along municipal lines, so that only further isolates these communities and shunts them into very small, narrowly defined schools, he said. Under a century-old state law, Connecticut school districts are defined by municipal borders, with local boards of education retaining full control over school districts in their towns. Towns can choose to form regional districts, but do so only rarely, and almost never with neighboring districts with drastically different racial or socioeconomic profiles. For years, advocates have advocated a more regional approach as a way of improving racial integration and economic equality. In 1996, a judge in the landmark Sheff v. O'Neill integration case called the law granting local control over education, quote, the single most important factor contributing to the present concentration of racial and ethnic minorities, unquote, in Hartford schools. Regionalization proposals, however, often face opposition from officials and residents of smaller suburban and rural towns who value local control and aren't anxious to share resources with neighbors. While there's currently no serious legislative push for a more regional approach to education, lawmakers contributed to debate school funding levels, with an eye toward helping reducing disparities between the state's wealthier districts and its poorer ones. The issue will be resolved in the coming weeks as lawmakers negotiate a final budget for the coming fiscal year. Connecticut's most unequal border between Hartford and South Windsor ranks 14th, according to New America's analysis, with South Windsor's median household income more than three times that of Hartford. In another front page article, this one by Chris Villalonga Vivoni, a study finds that one in three college students can't afford the cost of food. Every time she commutes in for classes, Dyla Hunter stops by the University of Connecticut Stanford's on-campus food pantry, Husky Harvest, to pick out a variety of free cooking essentials for her family back in New Haven. She said her family struggles to afford nutritious foods, so they rely on the pantry to help cover some of the high cost of groceries. For most of her life, Hunter thought their struggle with food insecurity was singular, until she learned the full extent of the problem in a Sociology of Food college course. It's also an issue officials are calling more attention to as they try to address the problem within Connecticut and the United States. Although it's not good that people relate to you in this way, it is comforting to see that it's not just me. It's a lot less embarrassing, Hunter said. When we feel like we need something, we find it super embarrassing, but it's never a bad thing to ask for help. College students are not typically the first group mentioned in conversations about food insecurity, said Molly Stradnicki, program manager at End Hunger Connecticut. The assumption is that students have access to food through meal plans. Still, hunger across Connecticut college campuses is on the rise as the cost of living, education, and food becomes more expensive. Nationally, more than one in three students reported not having enough to eat in 2020, according to a study from the Hope Center at Temple University. Other studies show students who face food insecurities have worsened academic performances and physical and mental health outcomes. In Connecticut, recent surveys conducted at public and private college campuses found significant food insecurity among students. A UConn student survey found 38% of students faced food insecurity, while about 30% reported skipping meals to save money across each campus. At Central Connecticut State University, 52% of 1,755 students surveyed reported that they couldn't afford a balanced meal, and 39% reported they had to reduce the size of their meals because they couldn't buy more food. Almost a quarter of students reported they went at least one day a week without eating because of their financial situation. Officials and students themselves have a variety of ways to help students facing food insecurity, including pantries and easier access to benefits. At the federal level, U.S. Representative Johanna Hayes reintroduced legislation to ensure that college students eligible for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program are notified of their options for public benefits. A report from the Hope Center at Temple University found that if enrolled as a single-person household, a college student could receive an estimated $281 per month in groceries through SNAP. However, in 2018, the U.S. Government Accountability Office reported that 69% of college students who met SNAP income limits did not receive benefits. Stradnicki said that the SNAP application is often a barrier in itself, since it's highly individualized but also very complicated, with many eligibility requirements, exceptions, and exclusions. Hayes said federal agencies already know a student's and their family's economic status through the Free Application for Federal Student Aid program. Notifying students of their eligibility and directing them to state agencies, she said, will remove some of the red tape and paperwork required to apply for benefits. If we can remove those barriers, I think we can see more students make it to completion, which ultimately the return on investment is much greater than what it would cost us to facilitate some of these programs, she said. It's one of those things that just feels really basic that we should be helping people in this country so that they don't go to bed hungry, she said. Students as a group should not be left behind, and college students are oftentimes left out of the conversation that we're having. In Connecticut, all 6 public universities offer 1 or more food-related assistance based on their community's specific needs, including annual holiday food baskets, counters where snacks can be grabbed, and mobile food pantries that will even deliver. The most frequently used initiative to address food insecurity is on-campus food pantries for college students and staff. Connecticut Food Share said its partners with 20 college pantries statewide and distributed nearly 400,000 pounds of food over the past year, enough for about 330,000 meals. The Connecticut Conference of Independent Colleges reports many private universities have similar food assistance systems to public colleges, such as food pantries and grocery store gift cards. Also from today's front page, in an article by Catherine Lutke, developer plans housing and retail space for West Cedar Street. In Norwalk, a local construction company owner has gained approval to build 2 buildings on West Cedar Street, including 14 housing units. "I was born and raised in Norwalk," Gino Matera, the property owner, said during the Planning and Zoning Commission meeting last Wednesday. "I worked and owned Ole Matera Construction Company for 41 years. My business is based out of Norwalk. I've noticed a potential in this area for a while, which is why I'm excited to have the opportunity to build this mixed-use building, because I can bring together families and businesses throughout the 14 dwelling units and 2 retail spaces," Matera said. "I hope that you view this project as something that would help revitalize the area." On the corner of West Cedar Street and Scribner Avenue, 175 West Cedar Street is a small and mostly undeveloped lot near the Best Buy and TJ Maxx on Route 1. The property is across from the Norwalk Housing Authority's Oak Grove project, where 69 affordable units are under construction, along with a community center. Matera's plans to build 2 buildings, an apartment building with 12 units, and 1 mixed-use retail building with 2 townhomes on top. Of the 12 units, 2 would be reserved as affordable units. The apartment building would offer 2 levels of parking and 2 levels of units with a rooftop amenity space. The retail spaces could hold up to 2 tenants or be combined for a larger space. The townhouse units above the retail would each have 2 bedrooms. Solar panels are contemplated for the roof and the larger residential building, with electric vehicle charging stations proposed outdoors between the 2 buildings, attorney Elizabeth Succi said. The P&Z Commission unanimously approved the application. "Very glad to see new development in this area. I think it'll be nice," said Anna Tabanchek, a P&Z commissioner. With a long history in Norwalk, Matera said he's familiar with the West Cedar area. "When I was a kid, my father built the adjacent property on West Cedar Street, number 167, and he built that in 1978, he said. "My family also purchased 175 West Cedar Street, where I'm proposing to build this mixed-use building." Also in Norwalk, a city educator is to lead a magnet program funded by a $15 million grant. This article by Colleen Rose Ozanek. The principal at P-Tech Norwalk is moving to lead the district magnet school assistance program, and the school's assistant principal is stepping up in an interim role. The Board of Education approved P-Tech principal Victor Black's appointment as the MSAP project director at a meeting last Tuesday, March 19th, where assistant principal Beth Funare was moved up as the school's interim leader. Both administrators will assume new duties on Monday. "I'm a little bit hurt that you won't be the principal that will be graduating my twin boys," Superintendent Alexandra Estrella said, lightheartedly at the school board meeting. Black and Funare were integral in bringing a $15 million federal grant to expand magnet school access to more students across the district in October. "It's, of course, awesome for the federal government to recognize our project here in Norwalk is awesome and funded," Black said. "I'm looking forward to work with the principals to execute our proposal as they expect us to." The Magnet School's Assistance Program funding will budget approximately $3 million each year for the next 5 years to be divided among Kendall College and Career Academy, Ponus Ridge STEAM Academy, and P-TECH Norwalk. MSAP funding aims to prevent minority group isolation and promote socioeconomic diversity in schools, a Norwalk Public Schools statement said. These funds will allow for the creation of inter-district magnet schools, providing the opportunity for all children to receive a high-quality education despite their geographical location. Black initially joined Norwalk's district in 2006 as the instructional technology staff developer for the school board until 2010. He was the assistant principal at Ponus Ridge STEAM Academy from 2011 to 2012 when he left the district. He also worked in Bridgeport from 2012 to 2019, first as the principal for Waring Harding High School for a year, and then the principal of the Information Technology and Software Engineering Magnet High School, a magnet school that he helped found with 70% urban and 30% suburban students. He led the school to achieve a 4-year graduation rate of 94% by 2019. At the Information Technology High School, Black led the Magnet School Assistance Program between 2013 and 2017. Under his leadership, the Bridgeport Magnet School was reorganized as Magnet Schools of America Certified Magnet School and earned the Magnet Schools of America Awards of Excellence and Distinction. Fornari, who joined Norwalk's district as P-TECH's assistant principal in 2022, also previously worked toward magnet grant funding in a previous post. She joined Trumbull's Fairchild Wheeler Interdistrict Multi-Magnet Campus, comprising 3 high schools. In 2013, as the Magnet School's Assistance Program Magnet Research Teacher, becoming assistant principal in 2014, where she remained until 2019. The administrative changes at P-TECH were among 6 other appointment personnel actions and 8 resignations approved at the school board meeting. The board also appointed a choir teacher at Brian McMahon High School, a speech-language pathologist at Jefferson Marine Science Elementary School, a district-wide multilingual learner assistant education administrator, and a district-wide social worker. The board approved resignations from a special education teacher at Brookside Elementary School, 2 science teachers from West Rocks Middle School, a special education teacher at Kendall College and Career Academy, a speech therapist from Jefferson Marine Science Elementary School, an English language arts teacher from Roten Middle School, a speech therapist from Ponus Ridge STEAM Academy, and a special education teacher at Brian McMahon High School. In a front-page article by Pat Tomlinson, a Norwalk man gets 1 year in stabbing and solicitation case. A Norwalk man was sentenced to 1 year in prison in a connection with the stabbing of a Stamford woman who was pushed out of a moving vehicle in May 2022, according to police. Judge Gary White sentenced Sergio Chuta to 1 year in prison, followed by 3 years of probation during a hearing at the State Superior Court in Stamford on Tuesday. If Chuta violates his probation, he could face up to 4 more years in prison. Chuta pleaded guilty in January to first-degree unlawful restraint and soliciting sex as part of a deal with state prosecutors. The 52-year-old Norwalk resident was originally charged with first-degree assault, first-degree unlawful restraint, soliciting sex, and interfering with an emergency call. But Assistant State's Attorney Michael Nemec said that the state was forced to abandon the most serious charge in the case after their efforts to contact the victim were unsuccessful. After Chuta was sentenced Tuesday, Nemec entered nulls on the charges of first-degree assault and interfering with an emergency call. Chuta was arrested by Norwalk police on September 13, 2022, after a Stamford woman reported to police that she had been stabbed and thrown from a vehicle in the area of North Taylor Avenue around 8:40 p.m. on May 2, 2022. At the scene, police found a woman on the ground with serious injuries to her right leg. Norwalk detective Daniel Fitzmaurice wrote in Chuta's arrest warrant, "The woman was transported to Norwalk Hospital for immediate surgery." The following day, the woman told police that she had been contacted by a man she said identified himself by the name Jorge over Facebook. Jorge messaged the woman and asked to take her out, the warrant said. That night, a man police later identified as Chuta picked the woman up at the Stanford train station, the warrant said. When she entered the car, however, she told police she immediately smelled alcohol, and the man began yelling at her, according to the warrant. The woman told police that she asked to be let out of the car at that point, but the man instead sped off on I-95 and continued to yell at her. According to the warrant, the woman began to struggle with the driver, kicking him multiple times in his arm, shoulder, and head as he drove. It was at that point that the man pulled out a utility knife and stabbed her on her right inner thigh, right middle calf, and right upper arm. The woman said she pleaded with the driver not to kill her because she has children, at which point he slowed the car down, opened the passenger door, and pushed her out of the vehicle, the warrant said. During the commotion, however, the woman grabbed the man's phone and kept it with her as she was pushed out of the vehicle. Detectives later used the phone to identify Chuta as the suspect in the stabbing. A few days after the assault, police received an anonymous call with information on Chuta's location. The informant told police that Chuta was staying at an apartment on Spring Hill Avenue in Norwalk. The warrant said that when confirming the tip, police found a vehicle fitting the description given by the stabbing victim. Investigators seized the vehicle, later finding at least two areas of blood in the front of the vehicle. Police said that the warrant they tried to contact Chuta unsuccessfully for about a month before they located him. Chuta told police that he had arranged to have sex with the victim for $100, but when she got into his car, she took $1,500 and his phone, according to the warrant. He claims that she refused to give him back the phone and money. Then when they reached a traffic light on North Taylor Road, she opened the door and fell on the ground. I never touched her, hurt her, or cut her with any type of knife. I got scared and left, he told police, according to the warrant. In New Canaan, a renewal takes wing. This article by Molly Hirsch. Coming up on 5 years of planning and work, the revitalization of one of the country's oldest bird sanctuaries is finally approaching its final stretch in time for its 100-year anniversary. During its meeting last Tuesday, the Board of Selectmen approved $240,900 for the fourth and final phase of the Bristow Bird Sanctuary Revitalization Project, honoring the sanctuary's 100th anniversary this coming September. Located by Mead Park off Old Stamford Road, the 17-acre Bristow Bird Sanctuary is the third oldest bird sanctuary in the country, with at least 117 species of birds sighted over the years. Friends of Bristow Park Chair Chris Schipper, who has been a part of the revitalization project since its inception in 2019, said he was already seeing more vibrancy in the park. This is what I'd call the kernel of conservation in New Canaan, Schipper said. We've kind of tried to restore it to that and set it up for the next 100 years. Much of the final stage has been to improve access between Mead Park and the sanctuary with a flexi-walk trail connecting the Mead Park Lodge parking lot to the sanctuary and the lower baseball field, making the park more accessible, especially for senior residents. The site will also include an observation deck and the return of a statue of St. Francis of Assisi, known as the patron saint of animals and the environment. The original statue of St. Francis, which stood at the sanctuary for decades, was removed more than 20 years ago after it was vandalized. Still to be approved is a sidewalk extension from Park Street to the sanctuary, which will include a four-car pull-off area that could also accommodate a school bus. According to Public Works Director Tiger Mann, construction bids came in last Thursday and will likely come to the selectmen in the next couple of weeks. The entire project is funded by a public-private partnership between the town and the Friends of Bristow Park. According to Mann, the town has contributed $509,500 and the Friends of Bristow Park have raised $200,000. During the public comment portion of the meeting, several residents voiced their support for the continued investment in the sanctuary, including Chris Herring, who lives just down the street from the site. It's fun to see people use the park, Herring said. It continues the Green Link, and I would argue that those smaller investments create different nooks and spaces for people to spend time in the park. I saw my daughter just over the weekend, found some goldfish in the pond, and was enamored by that. So I think it's a nice destination for folks to walk through and connect to town. Once approvals are out of the way, Shipper said that he anticipates work to kick off over the next several months between now and September, on schedule for a planned celebration. To celebrate the 100-year anniversary, the Friends of the Bristow Bird Sanctuary will host a centennial celebration on September 8th at 2 p.m. The event will include a keynote speech from ornithologist David Sibley, a musical performance from local composer Gwyneth Walker, and an unveiling of the St. Francis statue. With the end in sight, Shipper said that he was grateful to see so many in the community supportive of the work. There's just a great history of citizenship involved in this park, Shipper said. I feel like I'm just one in a chain of players looking after this park and the beauty of nature in this town. It's been a fun project. Shipper said his eventual hope is to see a walkway that could connect the Bristow Sanctuary to Waveney Park, completing an emerald necklace that spans all green space in New Canaan and highlighting the often-forgotten sanctuary. As the satisfaction comes when you see people come in, Shipper said. Making it a town asset is a win. And in Wilton, a bridge takes shape at Lover's Lane. This article by Karen Tensa. Construction crews have been busy with work underway on a bridge replacement project on Lover's Lane near Merwin Meadows Park. Motorists last week faced intermittent closures on Lover's Lane as a crane and bridge beams were delivered and installed at the work site. The entire bridge replacement project is expected to be completed this summer. The work this spring is the latest step in installing a new 60-foot bridge that will carry Lover's Lane over the Comstock Brook near the park. Lover's Lane, which is off Ridgefield Road, also known as Route 33, opposite Wilton Center, connects with Merwin Lane. Both roads are dead ends, and there are about 10 houses, as well as the Wilton Play Shop along the road that leads to Merwin Meadows Town Park. Last year, a temporary bridge allowing one lane of alternating traffic was installed on Lover's Lane. It temporarily replaced a 90-year-old bridge that was functionally obsolete, had structural problems, and was only 16 feet wide. The total cost of the construction of the replacement bridge was estimated at $2.7 million to $2.8 million in 2020. The town will be responsible for 20% of the cost, with federal funds paying the remaining 80%. In other news, Hurley sounds off on Big East snubs. This article by Christine Butterfield. UConn men's basketball coach Dan Hurley spoke out Sunday night about the NCAA's decision to only include 3 Big East teams in the 2024 NCAA tournament. You've seen how other leagues got their bids that our league deserved have underperformed, Hurley said, after UConn's win over Northwestern. UConn, Marquette, coached by Shaka Smart, and Creighton, coached by Greg McDermott, have all advanced to the Sweet 16. According to Hurley, the 3 coaches have discussed the conference's lack of bids in their own group text chat. There's also a chat involving all of the league's coaches, me, Shock, and Big Mac. We've got a group chat going, and with the other coaches in our league. But it's quality over quantity for the Big East, since each team selected will play in the Sweet 16, and all the coaches are rooting for the strength of the conference. I know Val Ackerman, the Big East commissioner, is excited too, Hurley said. Obviously, the mistake was made. It sucks. In today's life tributes, Robert Dwight Bixby, formerly of Norwalk, passed away on March 20th. Beverly Ruth Bragg Finch passed away peacefully on March 21st. And Oscar O. Vasquez of Norwalk passed away on March 24th. And that is all the time we have for today. I'm Brian Burgess, and I've been reading from the Wednesday, March 27th edition of the Norwalk Hour. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.